Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
You are listening to TNR with EWC on RFB, Radio Free Brooklyn. Welcome to episode 246 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours with yours truly, EW Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we have critically acclaimed writer, journalist, and National Magazine Award winner, John Marchese. We talk with John about his two books, Renovations and The Violin Maker. We also talk about his writing for the New York Times and the Philadelphia Magazine, his process, how he picks his focus areas. We talk about the violin, and we talk about reconnecting the father and son relationship through renovating a house, among other things. It's a very, very good conversation today with writer John Marchese. We also have an EW essay by yours truly titled Louie and Al. We have an Uncle Cesare installment by our associate producer and resident essayist, Dr. Michael Pavese, titled The Globe. And we have a poem titled Chestnut. And as is always the case, all of this is infused by several great tunes. Let's get to it. Episode 246 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours. Louie and Al. Is Louis C.K. a martyr, a barterer, a marauder? Why should we care at all what he does when the sun falls, as we spin and tilt on our axis, laying back on our asses, as his shaft bemused and ill-gottenly festooned in an air of aroused dominance and exhibitionism to reach orgasmic depths while they witness? as part of the act, or asking for permission, or inviting an individual to an event that is weird with one of a non-intimate connection? Is it an impulse allowed to actualize because of the sense that you have power? Would it still occur if the power was not there simply because of an uncontrolled, really strong desire? It seems for many of us males that our sense of entitlement and normal house of privilege is coming down. Are our species' natural ways, stemming back to ancient days, coming into a more evolved sort of scrutiny? Is the support genuinely steeped in morality and ethical reflection? Or is it instead a forced defection and mutiny? Are we willing, able to shift or turn upside down, inside out? What are you talking about? Poof! Magic wand in hand, soul, spirit, animal instinct, cultural teaching, an intellectual fancy dance. Why do so many people have a problem keeping it in their pants?
Well, I'm a crazy mixed up kid, and I love to dance like this. Well, I love to rock and roll, 'cause it satisfies my soul. You give me music with the beat, it knocked me off of my feet. I don't care what you heard, this is a crazy mixed up world. Crazy mixed up world. Crazy mixed up world. Crazy mixed up world. I'm in a crazy mixed up world.
John.
John Marquez, is this you?
Yes, it is.
All right, thank you so much. This is EW Conundrum from Troubadours and Rock On Tours. And before we get started, I'd like to give the folks listening a little background, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
John Marquez, and I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly.
Well, I say Marquez, but go ahead.
Yeah, Marquez, that's the way I would say it, actually. There are some Marquezes, as they say it, in my hometown. That's what I went by, but Italian.
It's my hometown, too, and that's how I grew up, the name Marquez, but I had to change it later when I moved away, and people said, that's not how you pronounce your name.
Oh, we're on the same page. Well, Mr. Marquez is a writer, a musician, an award-winning journalist. Actually, he's won the National Magazine Award. He's a critically acclaimed novelist as well. He has two novels, renovations and the violin maker that we're going to talk about a bit. And he lives between Narrowsburg, New York, and New York City. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's get started with the musician part, and then we'll get into the writing part. Because I didn't read a lot about in the bio, and I don't know much about you as a musician. I do know a bit about you as a writer. So how about the musician part of your life?
Well, I have to say the musician part of my life is a very undistinguished story, but I spent about 20 years as a professional musician, but a real work-a-day type player. I went to music school for a while, went back to music school for a while, lived in Philadelphia, studied there, and worked in a wide variety of just real workman-like musical situations. Everything from, I used to play the Ringling Brothers Circus when it came to town. I would play operas, big bands, Latin salsa bands, little jazz groups, you know, whatever came up.
What instruments?
I'm a trumpet player and played a little bit of piano, like jazz piano, which is my avocation, really. I never took a piano lesson.
So you play by ear?
Not by ear. I can read music. I cannot sit down and read Chopin or Mozart, but I can read what's called a lead sheet, which is the melody of the song and the chords above it, and turn that into something that sounds reasonably like something you would hear in a cocktail lounge somewhere.
And this experience must have informed the writing of your novel, Violin Maker, I'm sure.
Yes. Well, I don't mean to correct you, but both of those books are actually nonfiction books. They're not novels. So the Violin Maker came about in a very strange way. It's a weird publishing story, and that was my second book. And an editor who had read my first book, Renovations, which also was like a memoir, nonfiction memoir, called me and said, I wish I could have done Renovations, but I'd like you to do a book for me. I have a really nice cover illustration of a violin for a novel that I'm not going to be able to use, but I'd like to use the illustration. Would you want to write a book about a violin?
So, nice.
She knew I was a musician, and that was, she gave me some money to go out and hunt for a story, and I did that and came back with a proposal, and we signed it up, and the idea was the craftsmanship involved in making a violin, and I found a very distinguished young violin maker here in Brooklyn, New York, who's one of the top people in the world at this point, and did that book.
Well, I just want to say, just out of... I guess clarity and the type of ignorance that I have. It's not that I didn't know they were nonfiction. I did know that. I just thought you could call a nonfiction book a novel. I thought there are nonfiction novels and there are fiction novels. That's my ignorance. Not that they.
Oh, okay.
So let's clarify my ignorance first of all.
Okay, I didn't make up much in either of the books. I will say that.
Excellent. I didn't read either book, but I've read a bit about them. The one that fascinates me most right off the bat, I mean, I think they're both fascinating stories that you went into, but I guess the father-son relationship that is rediscovered in Renovations, you know, I'm Italian-American as well, and I just project that maybe there was some stuff going on with you and your dad that probably would be going on with my dad and myself if we were in the same situation. So how did that go when writing it? Was it a struggle in some ways?
It was a tough process, yes. I came up with the idea. It was something I just always wanted to do, and the renovation we did was a house in the country up in Narrowsburg, New York. And I just got the idea at some point. At that point, I was just about getting to be 40 years old, and I realized my father and I had done nothing together for decades, and I thought this would be an interesting thing to do, and I felt like I was missing something. Everybody in my family was blue collar. My father was a lath or plaster. The other side of the family was this long range of plumbers, electricians, telephone installers. As I say in the book, the the one relative, my mother's brother, who became a state policeman, that was as if he had become a, a Rhodes Scholar and gone to Oxford. And he was held up in great esteem for having what was considered a white-collar job. And I just decided that I'd like to learn how to do that stuff. And I proposed the idea to my agent, who had previously basically nixed every book idea I had, and he said, yeah, we could sell that book, and we did. So it was a weird situation in that I had the assignment before I had the story. So then we just had to go out, and I had to do the story and live and work with my father for, it took us almost 2 years. He was at that time 75 years old, so work was, at his pace. So and as they say about construction and renovation, everything takes twice as long as you expect. So.
Yeah, you always stumble on things you didn't anticipate.
Yes.
And did your dad, I gather from reading some of the summary of the book, he kind of thought it was humorous when he saw you at first with a tool belt on and he really had no experience in this way at all.
Yes. The family lore was that I had once hammered nails when I was 5 years old while they were working on some project renovating the house I grew up in. And that was the last time I held a hammer before this project, and he just couldn't believe that anybody would want to do that and also be in any way capable of doing it, because he had that very strong union outlook, which is that you apprenticed for so many years and then you were a journeyman and you learned the trade and you listened and you were browbeaten by your elders. And obviously I had not had any of that experience. We were just jumping into it together. So he spent a lot of time browbeating me.
Yeah, I think I could relate. And did you two? I mean, it's probably in the book, but for our conversation, did you guys sort of delve into maybe issues in your relationship while working together that maybe were unresolved at that point?
Yeah, I think we got to know one another better, and I think probably accept one another more. Yet one of the faults of the book is that I couldn't honestly say that we had any great emotional breakthroughs that you would see in a movie. And I should say that this book was commissioned around the time that the blockbuster bestseller Tuesdays with Maury was in everyone's head, and I truly believe that the editors expected it to be a Tuesdays with Maury, where there would be these, I don't want to criticize the book, but there were very easy revelations and lessons learned. And it wasn't easy with my father. He was not forthcoming. Neither one of us is a terribly revealing emotional person. So essentially we lived through the first 20 years of my life again for the second 20 years, and in a way got to the same place, yet because we were both older and more experienced, we realized, okay, this is who you are, and this is who I am, and we're going to have to take it at that.
And at the same time, you actually discuss, pretty significantly, some techniques and some approaches to renovating a home in the book as well.
Yeah, it was in no way a how-to, but I couldn't help but talk about what I had learned in this process. And I did learn everything from, I did all the wiring, I did a fair bit of plumbing, a lot of floor repair, sheetrocking, taping, spackling, painting, all the stuff. We did a complete down to the studs gut renovation. So I pretty much had to learn how to do everything. And, the odd side benefit of this is that while doing that, I ended up starting to write for This Old House magazine.
Bob Vila.
Bob Vila. My father and I actually visited Bob Vila while I was working on the book. And I wrote a profile of Bob for the New York Times in the midst of doing the book. And they invited my father to come along.
He must have loved it.
He was very funny. He was, he was scared as a cat, of course, because he wasn't used to meeting celebrities. But we went up to Bob's place in Cape Cod and had dinner there, and he and Bob actually hit it off quite well, you know, better than Bob and I hit it off, certainly.
And that gives me a nice segue to the articles you write for newspapers and magazines. You have written and continue to write for Philly Magazine. That's where you won your National Magazine Award, I believe. And you write for the New York Times as well on occasion. So how do you see these as two separate worlds when you of writing, in a way, when you write a book like The Violin Maker and Renovations? And when I look at the Philly Magazine articles in particular, so many great areas of focus in the many, many articles that I was perusing. How do you approach finding these areas of focus, these topics? Are they given to you by Philly Magazine, or you just find them?
In recent years, that's been my working arrangement with Philadelphia Magazine, is that I told them, just call me and tell me what you want me to write about, and as long as I have any interest, I'll do it. And I've actually found that to be more enjoyable, you know, because the ideas, I used to always say that somehow I come up with ideas for non-existent magazines. Nothing I actually want to write about is something editors are interested in. So I just find it more, it's easier professionally to have the editor come to you with the idea, because then you know they have a vested interest in it. And I like that challenge of having to become something of an instant expert on a topic.
Yeah. Would you call it investigative journalism?
I would not flatter myself to say I'm an investigative reporter. I don't have that kind of drive to get underneath things and find whatever the controversial story or anything like that. I think of it more as explanatory. I try to portray the world that the person I'm writing about, and usually you end up writing about people in magazines like this. They become the focus of the story. So you learn as much about that person's world and try to portray it as accurately and as interestingly as you can. And that's fun, and it's a challenge.
Well, you know, I have read a few of them. One in particular, One City in Pennsylvania is Poised to Crush the 21st Century. And the way you open that up, I mean, it really is like reading a novel. You set the scene beautifully, and, you know, you create a picture and an image that is pretty effective in getting the reader there engaged, and then you share what's going on. My compliments, and you know, again, it's like I'm trying to understand what kind of writing it is. I think you're being modest in a way. It is reporting, yeah, to a certain extent for sure, but there's a narrative that I'm getting too.
Well, thank you. That's I'm flattered, and if you know, I guess if I were to inflate it as much as I could, I guess there is the common term creative nonfiction, and I try to go into that area as much as I can. But I really don't consider. The thing I always thought about music was that doing music is basically a blue collar craft. You work at it, you learn how to do it, and you go out and do it as best you can every day that you do it. And if the art happens, it happens. And I really think that writing is the same way. You just you do your work, you do it as best as you can, and if somehow it becomes what people think of as creative writing, then great. But the best you can do is to be a craftsman on your best day.
So you're a craftsman in your own right. You talk about your ancestors being plumbers and carpenters and electricians, and you take the craft to the word, it seems.
I try to.
Yeah. And how did you get there? How did you find this for yourself?
Well, when I was a musician full-time in Philadelphia, I was in my mid-20s at the time, and I was just starting to break into good work. You know, I did a month where I was very busy and had good jobs. I did a television opera that paid well because it was on television and this and that. And then the next month I had no work at all and no work for the month ahead. I happened to have a degree in journalism and I took a job writing, and that's how it worked out. Became a writer.
So you had the degree and you needed to pay the bills, and you figured, hey, this might be more of a steady gig than finding musical endeavors.
Yes. So as I like to say, I'm probably the only person who ever got into writing for the money. and as the old line in Casablanca, I was misinformed.
It sounds like you're having fun at least, which is important.
It's fun. You caught me on a day where I blew a deadline. I'm working on a story that's a quite complicated tale of one of the largest investment companies in the country. I don't know what made me accept the assignment, and I'm feeling like I would rather be doing almost anything else.
One of those days, yeah. I think I could relate. And is this for a newspaper or a magazine?
It's for a magazine.
Yeah.
So it's a long piece. It's a 4,000 word assignment, and I'm squeezing out every word.
Yeah, 4,000 words. That's kind of challenging. It is, and I'm also interested in talking a bit about The Violin Maker, many more than 4,000 words. Your other book, nonfiction book about, as you mentioned earlier, the great Brooklyn craftsman Sam, and his last name, it looks like a difficult Eastern European name. I don't know how to pronounce it. Could you help me out?
Sure, it's Zygmuntowicz.
Zygmuntowicz.
Yes.
And you follow him through the process of making a violin in the way of aspiring toward the great Stradivari.
Yes, we went through literally from picking out the wood to the first performance of on the violin, which is a process that took about 6 months, start to finish. The commission was from a violinist named Eugene Drucker, who's a really fantastic violinist, and he's one of the founders of the Emerson String Quartet, which is a highly regarded, multi-Grammy award-winning string quartet. And Gene was playing on a 1686 Stradivari instrument.
Wow.
So Sam had a real high challenge to do something that would make Gene like this new violin better than he liked the old one. The thing about violins, those old violins, among players who were traveling worldwide and frequently going from one city to another doing concerts, they get very fickle with the travel because the wood is so old and they've been used. And so many of the players who have that kind of schedule, the dirty secret is that they're not really playing on their old violins often. They're playing on newer violins that aren't so fickle because the shape of the violin can change. Gene told me the story of going from, I believe it was Montreal in August, where it was incredibly humid, and then they went to Aspen, Colorado, where they were at high altitude and it was dry, and he said the violin just choked, and they were doing recordings, and he said, I couldn't play this violin. That's how bad it was. Wow. Even though this is a violin that's valued at, I'm sure, $3 million, and anyone else would covet being able to play that fiddle. But
it's not consistent, whereas something newer would be. And what kind of wood did you guys choose? What is the preferred type?
A violin is the what's called the belly, which is the top of the violin where the strings sit, and the top is where that have the holes in them, what are called the F-holes. That's always made of spruce because that's a sounding wood. It's if you pick up a piece of spruce that's been made even before it becomes a violin, if you tap it, you'll hear tones. It's a sound emanating piece of wood, and it's also very light and very strong. So that's used for that. And the back of the violin is almost always maple, And that's more of an appearance thing, because you can find maple that's got incredible flame patterns and things like that, and it just looks good and strong. So those are the two woods that are usually used in violins.
You are listening to TNR with EWC on RFB, Radio Free Brooklyn. Thank you for sharing that. And Eugene Drucker, was he satisfied?
No, he never really took to the violin, and it ended up going back to Sam Zygmuntowicz. Has a basic, you know, you guarantee your money back or an exchange policy. So Gene gave Sam that violin back, and Sam gave him another one that he had made, which was actually the one he made for Gene was based on one model of violin, and then the one he gave him was a little bit different model, and he took to that much better. And but then ironically, the one that Sam made that Gene rejected ended up in the hands of Joshua Bell, who is one of the, you know, foremost violin soloists in the world right now. So it didn't go unused.
Oh, that's great. So Mr. Bell did appreciate the way it sounded. It did.
Yes.
Work for him.
Yes, and Josh Bell has one of the most famous Stradivari violins there are. So, you know, he had a good comparison point.
And you went with Sam back to Cremona, Italy, where Stradivari was from, right? I gather.
Yes.
And why did you do that? Any particular reason? Just symbolically?
It seemed like obviously, when you're, again, going back to just the nuts and bolts of writing, you just need scenes, and I thought that this was a great scene to go back to Cremona and see what was going on there. And Mussolini was actually a fiddle buff, and under his regime they started a school of violin making in Cremona, which exists still. So considering, you know, Cremona is a pretty small town, I think maybe 80 or 100,000 people. It's rural. It's known as a cheese making center, but they produce many violin makers there, and a lot of them stay. Like, there's probably more violin makers in Cremona per capita than any other place in the world, and it's kind of a fascinating little hothouse place because of that.
And now we could say Mussolini made the trains run on time and also built a nice violin scene in Cremona. That's...
Yes, you can give him credit for two things.
And this novel, The Violin Maker, I correct myself again. I learned something from you today. I've learned a lot of things, but that one in particular, I think I've been misusing that word for years and no one ever knew to tell me, or no one ever knew. So thanks for that. But it's received a lot of critical praise. The New York Times, Newsweek, USA Today, Publishers Weekly, and so on. How does that feel?
Oh, it's great. But, you know, it doesn't help you write the next one.
Are you working on one?
Not at this point. I have spent some time coming up with ideas. And, in the time since I wrote The Violin Maker, the publishing world has changed quite a bit, and coming up on 10 even, and in that time I have spent a good deal of time researching ideas, and I'll, you know, a couple times I bring them to my agent, and my agent just says, great idea, but I can't sell it. Things are different now, people aren't willing to give money, because the books I've done have demanded a fair amount of research and time, and so unless I unfortunately don't have a trust fund, so I need to have something to allow me to spend that time and live while I research the book. So you have to depend on the kindness of strangers who happen to be your publisher.
Right, and I guess that's where the magazines, or the Philadelphia magazine, seems like a pretty steady gig that comes in handy, and the New York Times as well. And a few other periodicals you write for. The piece that you mentioned earlier, which I guess we'll keep a secret until it's published, is that the way to go?
There's no sense mentioning anything specific about it right now.
Well, you got me curious. So, if folks want to look and find some of your work, how would they do that, Mr. Marchese?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not that the idea of branding yourself and doing that and promoting is not something I do very well. So I don't have a website and or anything like that. So you just kind of have to look around. Obviously, if you Google my name, there are a number of things come up. And the Philadelphia Magazine website, if you go there, phillymag.com, and just put my name into the search engine, it will probably churn out most of the articles I've written for them in the last, 8 or 10 years. Same with the New York Times. If you just did John Marchese, it would put out probably everything I've done there. And that goes back to 1992, I think.
Yeah, you have a pretty impressive body of work, and I wish you continued success with your books and the pieces you're doing for the various periodicals you've been working with. And the 4,000-word piece that you're working on now, good luck with that.
Thank you. If you could help me with the ending, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, if you want to talk off air about it, I doubt I can help you at all, but I'd be pleased if I were able to. And the holidays are coming up. Any thoughts about the holidays? You have anything to share with the listeners?
No, I'm actually just deciding whether to come out to Scranton for the holidays.
Really?
Yes, I actually am inheriting a house in Dunmore from my last living relative. My father's youngest brother died recently, so I may be a part-time resident of Dunmore in the near future.
That's crazy.
The house needs, here's the irony of it, the house needs a fair bit of renovation.
Well, you're
so
an expert.
Here we go again.
Yeah, you're an expert now. You can.
Yes.
Well, you'll be in my hometown, so that's where I was born and raised, and that's where I live now, too. So when you're in town, maybe we can cross paths and share some holiday cheer.
I would really love to do that. And I hear there's some good Italian restaurants there.
There are a few, yeah. There are. I appreciate you taking the time out to share a bit of what's going on and your thinking regarding writing and music and such on Troubadours and Rock on Tours, John Marchese.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you. I hope I was helpful.
Oh, you were. A very, very interesting and enjoyable conversation. And again, I hope I see you over the holidays.
Same here.
Take care.
Have a good one. Bye now.
The Globe. Everyone in my depressed former coal town shopped at The Globe. It was one of the two main downtown department stores, Macy's to the Oppenheim store's Gimbel's. Everyone worked at The Globe at one time or another, or had a relative who worked there, just as nearly everyone worked at, or was related to someone who worked at, the town's correspondence school, or munitions plant. Just as, in times past, everyone, the males at least, worked in the mines. Everyone of a certain age is nostalgic for The Globe, with its elaborate and fondly recalled Christmas window displays, and its Monday money savers, and Wednesday specials, and the Charlemont restaurant, with the roast beef and Virginia ham carving stations, and tall Texan ice cream floats. A mother could spend a day with her children, mine did, with successive children as time passed, browsing the departments, searching for deals, and dining in the restaurant, perhaps having some of that freshly carved roast beef and mashed potatoes, or a chicken salad sandwich with rice pudding for dessert. Then mother and child would head home to spend the late afternoon watching Dark Shadows or Match Game or Gilligan's Island. And a father might take some time to buy a new hat in the men's department, and then go to the adjacent Hotel German lobby, where he could have his dusty wingtips buffed at the shoeshine station, or splurge on a trim and a shave at the barber shop. Then, barbersol scented, he might go next door to the Manhattan Room, with its Art Deco design and mural of the Manhattan skyline behind the bar. He might linger and have another highball, and then reluctantly return home to see what his wife bought at The Globe. Like everyone, I worked at The Globe, in the inventory department. We were a small, scrappy crew, headquartered in a dingy, dusty room on a top floor, far from the fancy displays downstairs. The mainstays were middle-aged women, smart Helen, a witty, single woman, who in another time might have become a journalist, or a professor, or run her own business, but instead cared for her widowed mother, never married, and worked at the store her entire life. Dumb Helen, who was lucky to have a job, complained constantly, was also single and amusing in her own way. Mary, another smart lady, who sang in a Welsh choir and had a fella. Stanley, our kind and put-upon boss, headed the department. He had to deal with demands and complaints from the owners, the department heads, his inventory ladies, and his wife, as well as the persistent pain of his hemorrhoids, which consumed as much of his mental energy as the inventory of the store. And there were the short-timers, who blew in for a couple of months, miscounted the merchandise, and stumbled on to another temporary job. Like Kevin, for example, who proudly showed us his girlfriend's portfolio, in which, clad in a not-too-flattering two-piece bathing suit, she stood holding gigantic model airplanes. As his contribution to the inventory team, he regularly graced us with a dead-on impersonation of Curly from the Three Stooges. You, of course, remember the immortal scene in which Curly bites into a grenade, thinking it's a pineapple. Kevin nailed Curly's pineapple. I was a short-timer, as was my friend Meehan. We counted everything. We counted furniture at the warehouse in a neighboring borough, up on a ladder, counting couches and end tables and ottomans and lamps. We counted clothes, trousers and shirts and ties, skirts and blouses and scarves. We counted lipsticks and perfumes and wallets and belts. We counted watches and necklaces and rings. We counted shoes, brogues and pumps and sandals and slippers. We counted brassieres and slips and panties. Or rather, miscounted. Because when you're counting panties, either on the busy sales floor, distracted by customers and comely salesgirls, or in a stuffy stockroom, bored and yearning for lunch, you have a tendency to miscount. We counted the entire store, and then we started over. My friend Meehan was a master at avoiding work, much to the chagrin of dumb Helen and the amusement of smart Helen and Mary. He taught me that you could go anywhere if you carried a clipboard with confidence. So after a mid-morning snack of a roll fresh from the store's bakery, we cruised the globe. We, or rather he, chatted up salesgirls, department by department. He swapped jokes, usually topical and occasionally painful, with fellow employees also avoiding work. He cadged discounts or freebies from the poor albino who managed the record department. The man's vision was so bad that he would practically have to press the albums against his face to read the covers. We stopped by the pet shop, where a pretty, bird-like girl sold noisy parakeets and bewildered turtles and doomed goldfish. Eventually, we returned to our crew in the miscounting of more merchandise, plotting our next chance to flee. The Globe closed years ago, famously locking out its employees when it did. Last year, the building, in the middle of its many transformations, briefly opened its cavernous first floor to a Christmas market. Our townsfolk flocked to the market, trying, vainly, to find that glorious store of their youth and their memories.
Chestnut. With the violin on my shoulder, feeling sort of older, and the bow echoes Coltrane-esque, soulful, as the stained cut of the old chestnut wood floor holds my creaking weight solidly, and the crisp November air coats the evergreens outside my window with a vibrant energy eternal. And there you have it, episode 246 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks that made this episode possible. First and foremost, writer and artesian at heart, John Marchese. I also like to thank Uncle Cesare, a.k.a. Dr. Michael Pavese, our associate producer and resident essayist, for another beautiful essay. I also like to thank these musical artists, Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli, Sharon Jones and Dap Kings, Eileen Jewell, Joshua Bell and Mr. Vivaldi, Billie Holiday, The Doors as well. Of course, Terrence Blanchard and Branford Marsalis too. Until next week, enjoy this one. Thanks for listening.